The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.
Hello and welcome to the IntraFish podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, editor-in-chief, joined by executive editor John Fiorillo. John, you were down in the Global Seafood Market Conference in Palm Springs, California, or at least near Palm Springs, California, I guess. And the GSMC, as it is abbreviated to, has been held annually. It brings together the top executives in the American seafood industry, and typically a great event. They give a rundown of, in particular, the markets in the U.S., but also generally the supply around the world for the key species, with kind of a focus on salmon, shellfish, shrimp, and whitefish, as well as kind of hitting on some of the trends among consumers. So I thought we'd start there and just get your impressions, John, of what the event was like. It was also slightly unusual, slightly different than others. And why don't you start by talking about that?
Yeah. The difference this year, obviously, is the loss of John Connolly, the leader of the National Fisheries Institute, which sponsors the conference. Lost John in November to cancer, and the conference started off on Sunday evening with what I would say is one of the most incredible memorials I've ever been to. It was just so well done, and you know, there were a number of speakers who spoke so from the heart and just about John. And you know what came out at the end of the night after you kind of distilled all this is, you know, John's sense of humor, his caring about the people in this industry as well as the industry, those were just hallmarks. And speaker after speaker touched on some very personal things John had done for them in their career or, you know, in their lives. And it was really well done. The staff deserves, I can't even tell you how much credit for putting that together, because, you know, they experienced the loss probably more than, you know, maybe anybody outside his family, because he saw them every day, and they've been dealing, you know, a lot of those staff, like we said a podcast or two ago, have been there for, you know, a decade or more. And so, yeah, so that's how it started out. And you'd think it would be somber, but it was really not. It was so many funny stories about John and his crazy sense of humor. So anyways, it was well done. And I think it was the right way to do things.
Well, you know, what's interesting is we've talked about this before, but across the industry, no matter where you are around the world, there is a vacuum of leadership, particularly in the next generation coming. And it's always been no more kind of apparent than some of these events, you know, some of these gatherings, especially the conferences. And, you know, it's something actually that John Connolly really talked about a lot, is the need for that. And I don't know, I mean, given that, do you think we've made any progress in kind of attracting a new generation into the seafood sector? Was your impression that you're seeing a lot of the same faces and a kind of a shortage of that?
No, I think we are attracting new talent. And you mentioned John's belief in that. Well, John, along with Wally Stevens and some others, created through NFI the Future Leaders Program, which has been going on for I can't tell you, at least a decade, maybe longer, probably longer. And they convene during this conference as well. So that program has been highly successful in placing people, not placing, but in educating the future leaders of tomorrow at companies across the seafood industry, whether they be shrimp, salmon, whatever it may be. So, yeah, I mean, you go to this conference in particular, or the Boston Seafood Show, and certainly you see the old guard. And but old is kind of an important word here. They are older, and you know you. Obviously, the likely path is that they'll retire and all that, but there is, I think, there is a pretty big flood of new talent into this industry, and they're paying their dues right now, right? And they'll get their chance. So, yeah, and you know, speaking of new talent, John's successor, Lisa Picard, will. She was on hand, of course. That was her kind of coming out party, and I thought she struck a nice balance between being available but not trying to, take over the event. And that probably sounds weird, but she was very accessible throughout the thing. And they had a little round table on the second day. In which she spoke a little bit, but everybody is now waiting to see what happens with Lisa and where things will go. And but I got the impression, talking to folks that hadn't met her, that she made a good impression on the crowd, so to speak.
Good. Yeah, it is going to be interesting to see, when you step into a role like that, there's so much to learn. And again, it's good to hear that you maybe were seeing some new faces at the event, and that, we've seen a lot of personnel changes in the past year or so. I mean, it's amazing the movement that's happening in the seafood industry, of people getting hired, people leaving, just all kinds of shifts. And so, that can't be anything but good, to bring some new faces and ideas into the fold, of course. Okay, so John, maybe you can just sort of to move us into some of the discussion points about the market. And I'm going to start with shrimp, because it's been in a really interesting situation over the past couple of years. There's been some real shifts, in particular of what of who's supplying the U.S. market. Coming into 2023, we have sort of a flat, slightly down level of global shrimp production. We know the first half's going to be a little bit down. We know that from lower stocking rates, the presenters were saying. So, what was sort of the outlook, you think, for that species from the panelists? Were they feeling positive in the long term, and what sort of hurdles did they see coming up for this year?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nervousness in the shrimp sector, both on the farming side and both on the sales and distribution side. Production is always an issue, and as you mentioned, production has slipped in 2022 and expected to slip a little further in 2023. In a natural world of economics, that would mean prices would be rising, and people would, in some cases, be happy. At least it's suppliers would be getting more, even if there wasn't as much available. However, in the current situation, not only is volume kind of retreating, prices are not strong. And demand has been weak, largely because of inflation, largely because retailers haven't been doing promotions of shrimp in store, which are really important to moving shrimp. They account for a big part of the energy at the consumer level. And so, you know, I think if you were to put it in a word, it would be, somewhat frightened about where things, it's hard to get a handle on where things are headed. So, I don't think you're going to see a lot of change, at least in the first half of the year. That's the way it sounded. And everybody's kind of waiting to see what the macroeconomics in the country yield, because until we know where the consumer is going, as far as its food purchasing, it's hard to say. So, I would look for promotions as a indicator of improving situation, at least in the U.S. And those may be coming in Q2 and beyond, perhaps.
So this is kind of interesting. I mean that, looking at the short-term figures on that, and I think shrimp seems particularly elastic when it comes to consumer spending in the United States, unlike salmon, which we'll get to in a second. But what is really interesting were some statistics that Nielsen presented there to give you a sense of quarter to quarter nervousness. Yes. The stats here on the growth in frozen food in general are kind of stunning. It's important to take a look back at that 4-year track where I'm seeing Nielsen showed that $2.6 billion in shrimp were sold in 2018, frozen shrimp at retail, and last year $3.8 billion were sold at retail. It's a $1.2 billion additional sales in frozen shrimp on the U.S. retail market. That's stunning. And while these numbers, the decline from 2021, down about $144 million in overall sales from 2021 to 2022, that's still really remarkable, I think, when you look at where things were pre-pandemic. You can really, I know there's been a lot of discussion about the pandemic bump has kind of, gone down or whatever. Certainly not in these statistics that they presented. If you look at 2019, again, you've added an additional $3 billion in retail sales in frozen seafood, shrimp, and or all frozen seafood, including shrimp.
Yeah, but part of the challenge there is a lot of that is inflation, because when you look at, and I don't have it in front of me, I'm sorry, but when you look at volume, you're not seeing that type of growth. And even if you look at shrimp imports right now into the U.S., they were down in 2021. They're probably going to be lower in 2022. So, while the value certainly you're seeing some change there, I don't know that that's translating to an expanding market. I don't think the two go hand in hand. I could be off on this, but we also have to remember that suppliers' costs have been soaring. So even if they are getting, even if they were getting more for their shrimp, a lot of it's being consumed in higher costs.
Right. I mean, there's since 20, speaking of inflation, so farm shrimp prices have gone up 4% since 2020. So, there's been a push there. And then also, you said there were some interesting presentations on costs and logistics. And when it comes to ocean freight and when it comes to all the fees involved with logistics, shrimp is one that is incredibly complex and really, really at the whims of the shipping sector, which saw record high prices and all kinds of issues at the height of the pandemic and in 2021 and earlier in 2022, which have eased a bit, but still are, you know, still are an issue. So.
Yeah, and cold storage is such a challenge right now. That was one of the main points during a portion of the conference, was just the challenge to literally find a spot in cold storage, particularly in the U.S., but elsewhere too. And Danny DiDonato, a cold storage expert, at Lineage, he kind of got everybody's attention when he said there's really no new capacity, cold storage capacity, coming online in the U.S. in any near term or even kind of midterm. There's just, you know, I think they're hard to build, in the sense that they're expensive. They're all robotics now. Most of, you know, you don't have a lot of human labor in these anymore, so that makes them more costly. But his point was like, hey, this is what we got. And until we get some of this product moving, you know, the shelves are full, so to speak. So I found that really interesting. Something I know we've reported on it somewhat, but I think it's something that we need to dig into a little bit more, to be honest with you, because it doesn't just affect shrimp, obviously. Any seafood that's, you know, frozen has to be stored somewhere. And yeah, so it's kind of interesting. He mentioned that the strategy for years has been just-in-time inventory, especially for retailers, but food service too. So, you know, the product flows through the supply chain just in time to get, you know, to where it goes. And so it doesn't spend a lot of time necessarily in cold storage. But now, because of the trouble in availability of product from overseas or wherever, a lot of companies have moved to this just-in-case mentality. And what that means is they're just going to keep more inventory on hand just in case they can't get more to back this stuff up that they're selling. So the result of that is that they're leaving it in cold storage longer. They're warehousing it longer because they don't want to run out, particularly with their bigger customers.
Well, let's talk about a species that does seem like it just does not care what happens with the economics, and seems to be more than able to convince consumers to purchase it regardless of the price, and that's farmed salmon. Now, interesting stats were presented by Kuntali, the analyst group, about the volume. We know that there's going to be slow to very limited growth for a long time to come. In the short term, there is expectation that there's going to be relatively short supply in the first half. There was a recent report put out by Rabobank that gave a little bit of light on to why that might be. Chile, which was expected to produce a lot more salmon, now is actually not looking like they will be doing that this year because of some disease issues that they've been struggling with. So it is an unusual time, and even though consumers seem to be more than happy to pay for it, as we know in the background, there's a lot of complexity. Norway, there should be a little bit of increase, but some in the UK, but for the most part, flat to declining, even in the areas that are kind of potential growth areas, you might say. So with around 1% growth projected, you are not going, and demand continuing to rise, you're not going to see an ease in price pressure. But there's other factors, of course, that they discussed. Tell me how they discussed the tax, the resource tax, and how has that been affecting sort of the market so far? And was there any projections on how it might affect things further as the year goes on?
Yeah, they didn't spend a lot of time on that, other than to say, you know, what is been said, you know, it's led to uncertainty, and these contracts that supply contracts are usually signed towards the end of the year for the following year, or, you know, 3 months or 6 months into the following year, those largely have been put on hold, and that makes it difficult for a retailer, for example, to know how much they're going to bring in at what price so they can put it on special in their weekly advertisements or whatever it may be. So while, yeah, it's definitely a factor, but I mean, the resounding soundbite from the salmon panel in particular was this, and we're talking about the USA because it's the US market that they focus on, but this insatiable demand that is showing no signs of receding at all. And, you know, you got done, and my conclusion, it's not new by any means, but my conclusion was salmon holds up the seafood department at retail, and salmon holds up menus at food service. Even more so on the food service side, because a number of the speakers talked about the shrinking menus at food service, a result of COVID, a result of labor, lack of labor in the house, and stuff like that. So the menus have shrunk. So a lot of seafood has been cast aside, but one that isn't is salmon. Salmon stays on. And, you know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You go to a restaurant, oh, I want some seafood. Oh, let's see, fish and chips. No, it's a little too heavy. Oh, they got salmon. Oh, okay, I'll get salmon. You know what I mean? So it's just this, I mean, it's astounding, like the demand growth at every level, right through the broadline distribution level and on and on. So
you can see in the statistics that Kontali presented in the slides, I have them here in front of me, but you know, you see from 2012 there was around a kilo whole fish equivalent per capita in the United States eaten. That's gone up to 2, and you just, you know, the real stunning takeaway is, as you said, John, the sharp rise in the U.S. market, but also in the EU and UK, which continues to grow. But, you know, it's pretty clear if these trends hold that the U.S. will overtake the EU and UK in the not too distant future. And that's quite interesting when you think about the overall general dynamics of the industry and how you serve it. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing that even with those prices, you know, you really, there's a little, maybe a bit more elasticity in Europe, and you see maybe a little bit of a reaction to those high prices in the demand when you look at the annual numbers there, but not in the U.S. The U.S. stopped growing as quickly as it was, but it kept on going right through all those record prices last year.
Well, and you know, Chile has long been the dominant supplier, obviously, to the U.S. Farm salmon supplier, and one of the slides they presented showed, let's see, kind of who supplies the U.S. market, and Chile has been increasing steadily since 2019, And Norway, for example, had been flat until 2021, and started to show like some growth, some significant growth. And the estimate when 22 numbers are all done, they'll be up again. Same with suppliers from other parts of Europe. So it's, the market has been discovered, for lack of a better expression. So there, as much as the demand grows, there's also this supply interest that is trying to meet it, not just from Chile, although Chile is trying to keep up as well, obviously.
I mean, it's really stunning when you look at the statistics from Urner Barry on the prices of Atlantic salmon versus, say, beef, chicken, pork. And I mean, it sits significantly higher than chicken, and beef and pork, and yet it just keeps. Keeps on climbing in consumption. It's kind of fascinating to see. Again, it seems like it's just not responding in the same way. And I think part of this is a glimpse at the future, right? Of what happens when aquaculture takes even further hold. And despite its kind of slow movement here and there, in acceptance among Western consumers over the past couple of decades, I think increasingly we're going to see big leaps in acceptance of aquaculture production, and I think salmon is really showing the way for if you can produce a product and at a regular interval with the regular size and people can depend on it, it's just going to grow.
Well, there's one slide in here that really caught my attention. It's the 5-year growth measured on dollars and then measured on volume for salmon. So I'm a little less impressed with the dollar growth just because some of it may be inflation, but I'll go through this. So the 5-year dollar growth on fresh salmon sales in the US, 49.4%. On frozen, 47.7. The volume growth, 5-year volume growth, is what impresses me. Fresh salmon, 31%. Frozen salmon, 12, roughly 12.5%. I mean, that is your fresh salmon market grew by 31% in 5 years. That's incredible. I mean, we're always kind of jealous because chicken is, oh, it's chicken and people just buy it because it's chicken. Well, salmon has kind of become the chicken of seafood in the sense that people seem very comfortable with it, very familiar with it, understand how to handle it, how to cook it, and are not at all afraid to buy it, and in fact are probably buying it. There were some stats in there I could look, but are probably making it part of their weekly grocery shopping, experience.
So, just one other thing to hit on here, John, if you could. What jumped out on and whitefish projections and shellfish, take those in either order that you want.
Shellfish, a lot of it was spent on crab. And crab looks like not the super best place to be. One of the things that caught my attention was, we can't import any of the Russian crab directly into the US because of the trade or the sanctions because of the war. So there was this massive import before the June deadline when hard stop, couldn't import any more Russian crab. So now we're starting to see that backlog or that import push is starting to go away. So the supply is getting is dwindling. Now, granted, it's not like there's a super demand for king crab at $39 a pound or whatever it may be. However, that backlog is going to be gone by probably second half of the year. And there's nothing coming in really of any size to fill that. So, the crab market is going to be really, I think, broken and fragmented for quite a while. I think the Dungeness crab that comes in on the west coast of the US, probably stay there for the most part. It can't fill the gap. So, unless, something happens where Russia starts shipping it through a third country that somehow can make it into the US, I don't know. Those things have happened in the past. So, but yeah, no, the crab will not be a fun place to play. It doesn't look like. And then whitefish, the same stressor is there, and it's Russia. And again, we're not importing much Russian pollock, but any that could have been can't. And but so much of it goes to China and is reprocessed, and that appears to still be coming in, in a pretty good flow. But quotas are high for pollock in particular, and the supply looks steady. Some of the US people I talked to said, their customers, all that they have is being sold to their current customers. There's no real prospecting for new customers. So that kind of tells you the market is tight, but it's satisfying its customers.
So it, interesting to see too, just overall supply, especially for Atlantic cod in particular, is really, it's slated to go down again by about 14% this year, which is it's a lot of fish off the market. And as you said, John, with Russia, it's just it's up in the air how these countries will handle fish that comes via China. I get the sense that so far, I don't think Europe will do anything about it, because there's just too much of a strong pushback, especially in Germany, where a lot of the frozen fish products are produced. But in the U.S., it is going to be interesting too to see the reaction to the China tariffs that were put in place under Trump, and our colleague John Evans has a story on that today on IntraFish, and actually a follow-up coming up tomorrow, the next day. And it's going to be interesting to see if any further doors are attempted to be closed on Russia this year, or if everyone's sort of done what they are going to do. You have Norway, which could take further action on cod landings, and here in the US, the At Sea Processors Association, which is five groups that are harvesting on catcher processor vessels, Trident, American, and on a few others there. And they want tariffs put in on those imports for obvious reasons. They're competing with them. On the other side, a lot of the processors like Highliner, Gorton's, which is owned by Nippon Suisun, Captain D's, a fast food restaurant chain in the United States, they all want them lifted. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see is if there are further arguments and investigations into the source of products coming via China. And I think the industry, the broader seafood industry, I think understands that. But I'm just curious, I think it's been raised in a few publications, mainstream publications here or there, that Chinese or sorry, Russian product is kind of making its way through the back door via China into the US and Europe. So it'd be interesting to see how that would be one more thing that changes, radically changes dynamics on whitefish.
Well, yeah, and the other point that was talked about with the whitefish panel is tilapia and pangasius. We've written quite a bit about, are these going to be alternatives to pollock? Are these going to be just general whitefish alternatives given some of the situation right now? So it's kind of interesting because there was a big discussion about menu penetration for these whitefish. And I'm just going to run through some numbers because I think they're kind of interesting. So the tilapia menu penetration at restaurants in the U.S., 7.4% in 2022, which is down.
So wait, John, what's that mean then? That it's made it into 7.4% of menus then?
Got it.
Okay.
In very simple terms, yeah, it's on 7.4% of the menus that this is data essential. So, but that's down from 12% in 2012, and it's been steadily kind of slipping. Pangasius enjoys a whole 1% menu penetration, which is horrible. Haddock, 3%. And then if you go look at cod, it was 12.4% in 2022, but it's usually hovering around 14%. So, it's those tilapia and pangasius, they would have a lot of work to do to kind of bring them back up or bring them up enough. But, that may be the best direction for a while. I don't know.
That was interesting, just the figures on awareness. And I think that the Alaska pollock industry at their conference a few months back, John, I think they mentioned some of the gains they've been making on menus, and awareness of the species itself. But, for all the ways that tilapia has really struggled in the United States. Part of it, the China tariffs that Trump put in place did jack up the costs quite a bit, and you did see some impact there on the volumes, and you've definitely seen a volume decline over the course of several years with tilapia. A lot of bad press there, I think, really did take hold. I think it was really was hammered on social media, which had an impact as well. And yet, 84% of consumers know what tilapia is. And that is, people would kill for that kind of awareness, of their products. So I don't think tilapia is dead yet.
No, I don't think so either. And I think tilapia holds up pretty well in some of the breaded and those types of value-added items. There's room to play in there, especially if the market is short on pollock, which is, kind of the dominant species for that portion of the retail channel and food service channel.
Right. Well, and then, John, you said there was a lot of sort of general trends to discuss that are kind of interesting in our news meeting this morning. We talked about some of the interesting millennial trends and how there's kind of two groups of consumers that are emerging. And, a lot of these trends are things maybe we've heard in the past, but there were some you said that jumped out that were different. The industry probably needs to keep its eyes on.
Yeah, well, the big one is, and this is not new information, but the boomer crowd, which has propped up seafood buying in the U.S. for decades and continues to be, the largest demographic for seafood purchases. That demographic in a very few short years will give way to the millennial demographic and the one behind them, Gen Z, I think I get confused, but And those will be the dominant purchasers of dominant consumers, period, of everything. But obviously of seafood, too, just because by default. But and this is a group that it's very interesting. They talked about the millennials now breaking into two kind of groups, kind of the older millennials and the younger millennials. And they behave a little differently across a lot of categories. But when it comes to seafood, you know, the older millennials, it's unclear. It's unclear where they're going with seafood, although they tend to seem to be more favorable towards it. The younger consumers, the younger millennials, I don't think they know yet. But what one thing to take away from that is these, whether they're the younger or the older millennials or the Gen Zers, you can't market to these people the same way you did to the boomers. I mean, we joke today, you know, your grandfather saw his ads in the newspaper. You see your ads on TV, or you saw your ads growing up on TV. Kids today, you know, they see their ads on TikTok and YouTube and those things. And that's how they have to be engaged. So if you're not in that space, if you're not sure what to do in that space as far as your marketing and all that, probably time to really double down and get serious, because that is the way you're going to need to talk to your future consumers.
Well, and you can feel kind of the industry, not just the seafood industry, you can feel the advertising industry kind of casting about trying to figure out how they're going to handle it, and looking for solutions for how they can, you know, inform people to satisfy their clients that are paying them to get awareness. So I thought that was really interesting. And yeah, as you said, John, I think it's sort of beyond, it's kind of beyond understanding for Gen X and older how some of these users sort of conceive of influencers. So yeah, that's another issue we're going to take a look at and help illuminate all of us about what an influencer actually is.
Well, and you mentioned tilapia and some of the bad press it got, and how it really affected sales in the US. They fell sharply. And where did it get all that bad press primarily? You know, on social channels, through the internet. You know, it wasn't necessarily TV shows or things like that. You know, it was all digital. It was digital brainwashing, if you will, or whatever you want to call it. So if you need any example of how powerful it could be, although in this case not in our favor, that is probably a good example.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see if companies can really figure out how to harness it. I think it's, you know, the industry has not traditionally been very quick to move on some of these trends, and so yeah, let's see if they get wise to some of these changes in marketing and informing consumers. Well, John, thanks for the update there on the Global Seafood Market Conference. It sounded like it was an excellent event. Of course, it still continues to be great to see people in person and to see things kind of picking back up. And that being the case, I think the industry is kind of back onto its slightly busier travel schedule in the first half. And so we have the North Atlantic Seafood Forum coming up in just over a month in Bergen. We will be there. Bergen's where one of our largest offices are. So it's always nice. We have a big contingent that is able to show up to that event. And then a few days after that, it is the Boston Seafood Show. That's the big one in the United States. And we will be there, of course. So we'll be available if you want to swing by and say hello to the editorial team. Let us know what's happening out there in the sector. Join us on March 13th, and we will have our leadership breakfast there. And we're very excited about it. We'll have some really fantastic thought leaders there. We've already got a couple that'll be joining us. Silver Bay Seafood CEO Cora Campbell, Clearwater Fine Foods CEO Ian Smith, and some others that are going to be joining. So don't miss that. You can go onto our site. Go to intrafishevents.com, actually, and find more info and register there. And so with that, we'll look forward to chatting with you next time.
The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.